From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. How do notions of personality and character today compare with such concepts in antiquity, in Greek society, for instance? Two scholars at the National Humanities Center are interested in that and similar questions. They are Christopher Gill and Lawrence Thomas. Christopher Gill teaches classics at the University College of Wales in the United Kingdom. Lawrence Thomas teaches moral philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. At the center, Christopher Gill is writing a book about Greek conceptions of personality and character. Lawrence Thomas is at the center to write a book entitled A Theory of Moral Character. Here is Christopher Gill.
Okay, well, I think the main thing is that character is something that's up to you. It concerns you as an agent, as somebody who chooses, who is conscious and aware of who he is and of the role he can play in making his own life.
Which is it, Chris, that one inherits? Is it character or is it personality?
Well, I'd say you inherit certain personality traits, just as you inherit a body. You inherit certain quasi-physical features that almost go along with that body, like being slow-moving or sluggish or fast. And I think you probably also, I don't know if you inherit, but I think you have, whether or not you like it, certain social features like being extrovert or introvert, though they may be modifiable. But I think to say that you inherit your character strikes me as very odd. I mean, conceivably you might inherit some things which might go towards the making of a character. But I think to say that you inherit a character seems wrong.
For instance, it would be surprising to say that someone inherited the character trait of honesty. Though, for instance, it might be that in terms of certain sorts of temperaments, personality temperaments, it seems perfectly clear. It makes perfectly good sense to say that someone inherited those sorts of things. But honesty, kindness, generosity, it boggles the mind to think of those things as being inherited. Though someone like Wilson these days might be inclined to say that all sorts of things inherited.
The sociobiologist.
The sociobiology, right. Mm-hmm. He would make the claim that one inherits most of these things.
Well, from the standpoint of the work that you're doing here at the National Humanities Center, would you say that character is more important or personality is more important? Is there a hierarchy here?
Well, my work is with the Greeks and Romans, especially the Greeks, and they were very clear that for them the important and interesting thing about a human being was his character. And they had much less interest and rather much less sense, really, of the notion of personality and a much less developed language. And for them, I think they were very clear that it was what was important.
What would be some of the differences between notions in antiquity and notions in modernity about personality?
Well, I think the basically the notions are very similar. That is to say, the where I would look in ancient theory for personality notions are the same sorts of places as I'd look in modern theory, that is, in a sort of scientific, a medical or physiological approach. And I think you have the beginnings of that. You have the beginnings of humoral psychology. You have the beginnings of a sense that people's body, in a broad sense, their whole bodily makeup, what they're given, contributes to whether or not the sort of sexuality they have or how various other features that border on the moral. But I think it's a much less developed language. I mean, today there's a whole growth of series of sciences, psychoanalysis, psychology, and so on, that feed into this picture of the person. And so it's a much more intellectually, it's a more central issue, I think, though I think you had the beginnings of it in the Greeks. But I think the essentially the same notions are there from the beginning. What interests me, really, is the idea that there is a whole kind of personality viewpoint abroad now. I mean, I think there's a whole kind of superstructure. And I think that certainly if you go from working in the humanities to reading papers, say, in sociology or planning or medicine, you suddenly stumble on a wholly different language, a wholly different way of describing people. And it doesn't use any of what I'd consider a character terms. It doesn't refer to the people it's talking about as agents or as having any kind of direct power over their lives or as being in some important sense different. They're somehow scientific objects or customers or something that leaves out this whole dimension of character. And that's what I find find interestingly different.
Because so the attempt to what? Quantify the unquantifiable?
Well, yes, it's partly that. It's treating people, I would say, as if they're scientific objects, as if there are all sorts of things about them that are given, and that you can describe all the things that are important without bringing in character. So you can describe people's intelligence or their physical abilities or their social background. Oh, and their personality. It's sort of something that's thrown in as an added element, but that doesn't somehow capture what's essential. So that, I think that's one feature of these kinds of approaches to people, which of course are very kind and very powerful, which I think is very unsatisfactory.
Larry?
What do you think?
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. Moral character is about persons, and so one ought to get a handle on what the parameters of human action come to. And a moral character that loses sight of that is going to miss the mark, it seems to me, in the sense of either demanding too little of persons or demanding too much of them. But getting back to Chris's point, in all cases we're talking about that sphere of things which are thought to be within the individual's control. So the very depressive person, their way of responding when they're depressed, mm-hmm. Is a different issue altogether.
Can you be specific and concrete?
Well, some of them are, I think, the things that people have always been interested in, the so-called virtues. I think people, different societies define the virtues differently, but I think all societies have virtues. They have qualities which they prize.
Like honesty.
Like honesty, or in the ancient world, they're very interested in courage and self-control. We value more things like kindness. We're very interested in the notion of altruism. Sincerity. Strength, I'd say, in a certain area. I mean, there are different kinds of qualities. I don't think one needs to be too restrictive. They're all qualities which one values, or which the individual and the society both value.
Well, it's fair to say that I think that Americans are aware of these qualities, and mm-hmm. they desire them, they strive after them, and yet we live in the midst of what's called the me generation. How did this split occur? What went wrong?
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to it, but I think there was particularly in the 60s, then in the early 70s, there was abroad a way of talking about the person that was very different from character, which talked more in terms of self-realization, of discovering oneself, finding oneself, identity. And I think, and I don't think that was all bad. I think there were very important and constructive sides to that. And I think it was a reaction against a rather restricted notion of the self, which had been current, perhaps all people had thought was current before. But somehow or other, that concern with self has turned into something lesser, has turned into a kind of what people now derogatorily call the me generation. And it all got mingled up with all sorts of things that I think had nothing to do with it, drugs and kind of way out political groups. And this really, somehow, the whole, the force of it has got lost. And I think what one wants to do is to recapture some of that concern, but to give it a broader base and to bring it into contact with older streams of thinking about the person, of character.
Yeah, I think what was also true about the me generation is that it seemed to me to have said that there are these needs that one must satisfy, and it's as if one can't help oneself. And this sort of goes back to the personality sort of approach. You've got these needs, you must satisfy them now, and it's a kind of an excuse for what one does, because if here are these needs, sort of onslaught of needs and desires and so forth, and I must satisfy them immediately. Well, you can't blame me if I do so. And I think when you shift to character, it puts the ball back in one's court, as it were. If I satisfy this desire or need now, you can ask me, why did I do it? And it's no longer a satisfactory explanation to say, well, it was just there. Because once you bring in character into the picture, you can ask the question quite forcefully, but did you have to satisfy that desire? Why did you satisfy that desire?
For a couple of academics, one a classicist, the other a moral philosopher, you sound awfully old-fashioned. Do I read you right here?
Yeah, well, I suppose I need to feel less apologetic about that than as a classicist than a modern moral philosopher. But really, do the questions change? I'm very skeptical. And I mean, if it seems to me that the important questions just go on, and that they've been with us and always will be. I mean, I think that the way you frame issues always changes, and I think that certainly, although I think these issues are there for the Greeks, they're not quite there in quite this way.
We have new equipment to bring to bear upon these issues, and so again, even though we're asking or addressing the same questions again, we're doing it from a fresh perspective. Aristotle didn't have sociobiology to bring to bear on these issues.
But I'd like to go back to this question of old fashion, because you see, it's a question of choosing among the available languages, and one wonders what range of languages, you know, what's modern? What, you know, it's a question of what's modern, mm-hmm. and what, whether there's enough stuff in it, whether there's enough material quality. And it seems to me that a lot of modern language about persons, there's no substance. People talk about roles or functions, talk about people as kind of economic units, or people as functional.
Educational gobbledygook.
Yeah, this, mm-hmm. that, and the other. But what one wants is a language that somehow does justice to us as persons.
Well, let me ask you two questions then, Chris. What is the language current today about personality and character? And what kind of language do you seek? What is it that's constant here that you're looking for?
Well, I think in a lot of areas there's no language about character at all. I think that language has...
You mean these things go beyond words? What?
No, I mean, I'm talking about the discourse, available discourses. I think in a lot of areas, a lot of the social sciences in particular, they're really, the whole notion of the person as character has really, really, really dropped away. And I think that there's clearly a developed language of personality in psychology, in psychoanalysis, and in our everyday speech. But the character side has dropped out. What I'd like to see is not a complete... going back to a kind of old-fashioned character language. I don't think we aren't going to go back to a Victorian character language, because we aren't Victorian in all sorts of ways. But I think what we would want is a language that is in some ways richer than the way, at least the way we think of a Victorian character language.
A little less scientific.
Yeah, I think we want to. I think we just have to realize the limits of science. I mean, I think people have been bowled over by science. Mm-hmm. I think people have been, for instance, I mean, take the two great figures of the 19th century in this kind of area, Freud and Darwin. I mean, they seem to unfold wholly new and dramatic and frightening pictures of mankind and completely alter.
And I think it's only primarily now, scientific pictures.
Primarily scientific pictures. But I think it's only now that people are beginning carefully to appreciate what the full implications of those theories are. And I think it's becoming clear that in some ways they're less than people had supposed, less adequate in their mm-hmm. implications than people had thought.
So while a little less scientific, no less true to the facts, though. I think that's important. I mean, the issue here is not that everything is up for grabs when we start talking about character, and you can have it your way and I can have it my way. I don't think you mean to imply that at all. So we want something that's still quite true to the facts, but rather we're suggesting that the models which Freud and Darwin gave to us are inadequate as capturing all of it. I mean, I think that's the way of putting it.
Yeah, they opened up, or they tried to open up certain sides or certain aspects of human nature that people had not recognized. And then I think thereafter people began to think this was the whole story, that you could take a completely, as it were, personality, a completely Freudian view, or a completely kind of genetic animal type view of human nature, and that this would somehow be completely adequate. And I think it just isn't sufficient to cover all the sides of human nature.
Chris, are you describing holism?
If by holism you mean trying to give an account of the whole person, then I very much am, or at least maybe not the whole person, but as large a scope as possible.
But not the kind that's marketed in popular magazines.
Well, I guess not. I'm not really sure what that is, but uh-huh. I don't. If it's giving an illusion of wholeness, but just making you feel wholesome or making you feel good or something, if it's really very superficial, then I'm obviously not interested.
This is not a quick how to improve yourself course that Chris is about. Program. I mean, this is not a quick how to improve yourself program that Chris is offering, I think. So it's holism in a very rigorous fashion, I think. And it's not a pop idea that you pick it up in the bookstore and so on.
It's what the Greeks called character, in other words.
It's what the Greeks called character, which was not, perhaps was not absolutely all of that. I mean, I think they thought there were sides which just mm-hmm. didn't fall
well, you mentioned courage and you mm-hmm. mentioned self-control. What else did the Greeks focus on? What did they think about when they talked about character?
Well, they were very interested in justice. They were very interested in fairness and generosity. They were very interested in, I mean, two, I suppose, broad areas. The way you operate as a person in the world in various kinds of ways, as a citizen, as a member of your family. They were also very interested in the way you operate with respect to yourself. And here you have qualities like self-control, truthfulness. I don't think they quite had a sense, I don't think they were worried about authenticity exactly and truth to oneself in the way that some people have been. But I think they really, whatever area of activities you take, I mean, they think there are some qualities there that are just more valuable than others because, and I think that perhaps this is the important point, they thought that they connected character very much with happiness. And by happiness, they just didn't mean having a good time. Or sitting around feeling happy. They meant a whole notion of the person as a substantial, well-developed, flourishing person. The notion of happiness, eudaimonia, for them, is very connected with the notion of flourishing, of being a full human being. Now, if that's holism again, I'm quite happy with that holism. So I think that it's... Well, I think they were very keen not to have a contrast, at least the philosophers, between virtue on the one hand and happiness on the other, between doing what's right as a citizen and being a happy human being. What they wanted to do was to see the ways in which those two things fitted together.
So when you add character to personality, you get a fuller, a richer being, the upshot of which is a happier being also. I mean, they were to go hand in hand together. You get a more complex being too, and I think that's something to bring out.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with two scholars at the National Humanities Center about ancient and modern conceptions of individual personality and character. My guests are Christopher Gill and Lawrence Thomas. Professor Gill teaches classics at the University College of Wales in the United Kingdom. Professor Thomas teaches moral philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. At the center, Christopher Gill's research project deals with ancient Greek notions of personality and character. Lawrence Thomas is at the center to write a book entitled A Theory of Moral Character.
I think if there's one side of Greek culture that I find unsatisfactory, that I don't feel quite at home with, it's that they weren't perhaps willing to push the question of character as far in the direction of personality as we could. Mm-hmm. They really thought that they had a sense that a good person, any good person, is the same as any other good person. Whereas I think there are ways in which there's the question of individuality has a role to play in the notion of character. It's very difficult to put one's finger on it and to trace it exactly, but I think it's something that is there and something we are in a position to develop. But I think you have to begin by thinking that character is important at all, which has not always been where we've been.
Well, one way that character can bear on personality is that if you have the right sort of character, you may want to, as we're trying to affect one's personality traits. Mm-hmm. Thus, if one is a very pessimistic person, perhaps, or a person lacking in resilience, well, if one has the right sort of character traits, one might try to modify that or at least take that into account in one's performances. Okay, so one way of understanding the relevance of character to personality is that, as we are aware of our shortcomings, people with the right sort of character try to compensate for them, to get around them, and so forth and so on. And so that would be a way of bringing character to bear on personality.
Yeah. Another way is that you recognize that there is a personality side to discourse, that people, as people say now, interact in ways that don't reflect very much about character, but they are a very important feature. There's a whole kind of undercurrent of emotional interplay between people, and the Greeks don't really talk about this very much. But if you do recognize, and if you recognize that it's there, then it can actually enrich, in certain ways, your notion of what the right thing to do is. Because there are certain kinds of... I mean, there are certain kinds of things which might, on the surface, appear to be the right thing, but they're really not, because, for instance, they're insensitive.
Yeah.
And I think that's something they didn't really describe, although I think they probably were aware of it in certain ways.
And if, of course, I know what my the strengths and weaknesses of my personality are, then I can use my character to accentuate the strengths and to avoid the pitfalls. And so that yet brings in more responsibility for me as an agent. When it comes to assessing a person's performance, vis-a-vis measuring up to this or that set of moral rules, you want to look at what would count as extenuating factors, what would count as an excusing condition, and so forth and so on. And when you start addressing those sorts of issues, that throws one into the, that one is required to take up the issue of character there.
So you're looking for some bedrock.
Yeah.
And how would you describe it? What's there?
I perhaps would make more of a fuss about self-control and self-knowledge. I think in the 1980s, it's very, very important to have a great deal of self-understanding. And so I would want to countenance self-understanding as a virtue these days.
How is it that one can avoid the pitfalls of these superficial quick fixes that you've been describing?
Well, I suppose there's no quick answer to that either. I mean, that's the whole point, is that what one wants, I suppose, is some kind of union of thought and feeling about these questions. Uh-huh. That it's not just enough to think deeply and to look at the available issues and theories or whatever. It's very important also to feel that this matters and to be true to one's emotions and so on. So I don't think one can really say there is an easy answer, but I do think in academic terms that it's just important to make sure that the question is there, that it's on the table, that you're prepared to raise these issues and not sure. Just to talk as you earlier did, you know, as used to be very fashionable. We'll talk about the language of moral statements. We won't actually talk about morality. We'll talk about the language of moral statements. And if you've done that, you've really cut the ground from under your feet to begin with. There is a real difficulty here, which is of knowing to what extent the scientific viewpoint really makes a difference for us, and just what difference it makes. And I think this has taken a very long time.
And your argument is that we have come to lean too heavily on the purely scientific viewpoint, is that it?
Well, I think that we perhaps haven't realized how much and how little science can say. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you see, well, if you take the Freud case, I mean, taking the modern era, Freud seemed to open up wholly new areas, wholly new dimensions of the personality of the human mind. And I think people thought that it was sufficiently true and important to completely turn around our whole idea of human nature. And I think now it's possible to realize that what Freud had to say was only part, and that in some ways it's very incomplete in its account of the person as an agent.
Did Freud announce his program as a complete program?
I don't think he did. I think he saw himself very much as speculating, as exploring, as pushing forward on the theoretical level the implications of his own experimental work. But he has nonetheless affected the way people have thought and the picture people have formed. Now, there's been a move recently to say that Freud really is a moralist. I mean, you have books published called Freud, The Mind of a Moralist, and some attempt to make Freud into the basis for moral character. But I think there are real problems with that, and I think that's something you're interested in, Larry. I don't the whole relationship between Freud and the moral agent, I don't think you can really pass from one to the other.
Not very easily, it seems to me. I think when it comes to psychology and moral character, people have felt very uncomfortable for a long time, supposing that we had a rich enough theory of human nature. Well, one might put it this way. With Aristotle or Plato, there weren't all these competing theories of psychology running around. Nowadays, there are many, many theories, and then so it's the problem with choosing any particular theories is that it seems to be loading the dice in a certain way vis-a-vis other theories. And so people have been reluctant to suppose that one could zero in on any given theory.
But I think there's another difference. I think they began from a different position. They began with a conception of the person. They began with trying to formulate in psychological terms a sense of the person as agent that they, in a sense, already had, but that they wanted to give substance to, psychological substance to. Now, I mean, the Freudian account arose in a very odd way. I mean, it arose from studies of neurotics in Vienna, and it's spread from a kind of a medical analysis to a conception of human nature. And there's a big gap between an account of how you're going to deal with sick people and man as healthy, man as as being able to do something, man as an agent, man as a person.
And see, one problem with the Freudian account is that, depending on how you tell the story, it's not at all clear how an individual could be a responsible agent, because there it all is with the id and the complex and so forth and so on. And, well, you are very much a product of one's environment. So, in a certain sense, Freud's whole program doesn't lend itself very well to talking about moral character, particularly when you want to make a fuss about moral responsibility.
I think they took that as a given. I think they presupposed that any satisfactory psychology had to be one that would make room for our sense of ourselves as responsible. The Greeks, I mean the Greeks, yeah. The major Greek theorists. And I think you may say that that's just moralizing psychology, that that's building in too much. But if that's something you think is very important, or something that ought to be part of any account of human nature, if it's to be true to what we actually are as human beings, potentially, then I'm not sure that is loading the dice any more than it's loading the dice to begin your psychology with madness or neurosis. But what I'm trying to do is to put myself in the position of the critic of Plato and Aristotle, who wants to say, well, all this stuff about the soul or psyche is fine, but it's just phony, it's just moralizing. Now, that seems to be something very wrong. I mean, just moralizing presupposes that there's some fundamental opposition between moralizing and human nature. And that doesn't seem to me something that you can very easily do.
On a Freudian account, for instance, I mean, we might come out as relentlessly self-interested. And that picture of the self doesn't lend itself very well to talking about moral character. But I think we've gotten away from that, and we've gotten away from the sort of Freudian personality notions. And so we have a richer conception of ourselves and something that we seem to be more fundamental and core. We don't think of it as being loaded. I mean, I guess the best way of putting it, there is nothing wrong with having or starting with a particular conception of the person or of the self, so long as you can show that it isn't, how would you say, biased or at the outset. I mean, to have a particular conception of the person is not thereby to have a biased or unwarranted conception of the person. And I think we're coming around to accepting that fact. And I think somehow we suppose from science that to have a conception of the person was already to have a value-laden view of the world, and that was a bad thing. But that doesn't fall. I mean, that may be true that you have a value-laden view of the world, but it doesn't fall from that fact that it's a bad thing. And I think it's being clear about that that has been helpful.
Yeah, there's an attempt to deny something very important. Yeah. I mean, the attempt that you can, as it were, completely escape your own position, your own values, your own sense of where you are as a person, or where people are as people, that's really seems false in some ways. Yeah. False to what one's picture of what a human psychology ought to be like.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guests were Christopher Gill and Lawrence Thomas, both of whom are scholars at the National Humanities Center. Christopher Gill teaches classics at the University College of Wales in the United Kingdom. Lawrence Thomas is a professor of philosophy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.